Good evening, friends. My name is Steve Elkington. I'm on the program committee, and they thought I might enjoy moderating this session. And when I heard who was on it, I couldn't have been happier. I was going to be introducing three speakers tonight, but one is sick. So we have the fortune of two wonderful folks. And as we are comparing notes here as the session was gathering, I've discovered they're both ministers. So we may be in for some great exhortations, let's hope. So we have with us Jolie Robinson, who's a long-term activist and member at Adelphi Friends Meeting. I first knew Jolie, ran into Jolie about 30 years ago when my then wife and I were getting ready to get married and went to Adelphi meeting. And there were three interracial couples sitting not only in the meeting but in the center of the meeting. And Jolie and Ted and their kids were there among them. And I thought, this is a great meeting because people here are really relaxed about racial issues. I could feel comfortable here. So on and off, we've been friends, and it's wonderful to present her to you. So she has a whole long and wonderful story to tell you when it's her turn. Micah Bales, I met just recently, and I met him actually through his wife, Faith, who works at William Penn House. And as I've been exploring the new edges of Quakerism just in the last couple of years, including things as recent as the Occupy movement in D.C., there's Micah. He's on the front edge of what makes Quakerism work today, at least in terms of social action. And I can't imagine, I mean, there are many people in this room, there are many people in the whole yearly meeting who could speak on this topic of spirit-led social action. But these two, I think, in the stories they're going to tell us, will pull together a whole series of impressions of events, of their feelings that will resonate with each of us. So the way we'd like to do this is to enter into worship, and then Jolie will take the mic when she's ready and will speak for about 20 minutes, 20 to 35 minutes, 20 to 25 minutes. And then before we get into questions for her, Micah will have his turn, and then we'll break the silence after he's spoken, and then it'll be questions and answers. They're both eager to dialogue with you, so feel free to move forward a little bit. Feel free to make this into our session rather than just their session. So I don't know, should we close the door to make it a little quieter? How about the last one incoming in the door? Could you just close the door so it's a little better? Or is it noisier when the door is open? Okay, nice, sweet. So let's have some worship together and celebrate a wonderful day so far, and this is going to cap it off mightily.
When I was first asked to be on this panel, I was thinking that I was going to go through all the social action I've done in my life. And then I started thinking that what you really want is what's going on now and what kind of social action is going on in this yearly meeting area. So I revised it somewhat, but I can't resist starting at the beginning. And the beginning was that, and when I was 11 years old, and I'm glad the GIFs are here to hear this, when I was 11 years old, we moved to Nashville, Tennessee for a year so that my father could go back to school and get another degree. And the custom in the part of town where I lived, I don't know whether it was the custom everywhere, was that if I was walking down the street and a black person was walking down the street the other direction, he or she would leave the sidewalk and go into the street, into the gutter, so that the white person would have the right of way. And that just felt absolutely wrong to me. And people were doing that, adults were doing that to me, you know. And so I did my own little social action, which was that if I was walking down the street and Steve, who was African American, was coming the other direction, I would go off the sidewalk before they had a chance. They must have thought I was crazy. But it was my witness at that point, the thing that I thought I should do because I thought the custom was wrong. It was not a law, but it was a custom. And the other thing that happened, and my mother was working at the state hospital, and we occasionally went and ate with the upper-level staff at the state hospital, the psychiatrists and nurses, and at the dining hall there, all of the waiters and waitresses were African-American, and the procedure was if you wanted something, you rang a bell that was in the middle of your table. The person would come, not say anything to you. You wouldn't look at them, and you would say, more rolls, or whatever it was you wanted. And that felt so wrong to me that I decided that I would not do it that way. And so when the time came for me to want something, I'd ring the bell because that was the only way to get somebody to come. And they would come, and I would look around, look them in the eye, and say, could I have some more rolls, please? And that was my second witness. It wasn't spirit-led. It was just morally something that I felt that I needed to do. And I continued that kind of witness. In college, I decided I was a pacifist. I was a Methodist. I was not a Quaker, but I decided I was a pacifist because a man came and spoke at our Wesley Foundation, and he was so engaging about why you should be against war and be totally committed to not participating in war. And so that became my witness. And when we went to when I went to seminary, you would think that I would start doing spirit-led social action, but I didn't really. What I was doing then, and this was in North Carolina at Duke Divinity School, and it was in the days when the buses were segregated and most everything else, the schools were segregated, so on. And I made a point of, when I rode the bus, which was quite frequently, I would get in the back of the bus behind somebody who was African American. And but it was more of a in-your-face nonconformity witness than it was a spirit-led witness. And even though here I was training to be a Methodist minister, I did that. on a sort of a, I don't like this, and I'm going to show you I don't like it. So it wasn't, I could go on about other things that I did during the time that it was in North Carolina, but they would be a little bit irrelevant. Although I must admit I was sort of an angry social activist at this point. And I was doing things out of a feeling of anger and wanting to show people how wrong they were, rather than out of any spirit-led motivation. And it wasn't until I became a staff person for the American Friends Service Committee that I started changing that way of looking at social action. And I remember one particular instance. And this was in a day when this was in, I was in an Ohio, Michigan, Indiana, and Kentucky region. And I was what was called the College Project Secretary. And there was a plant in Indiana that was involved in chemical warfare, chemical weapons production. And the peace secretary and I decided that we really ought to have a silent vigil at the plant. And so we presented this as something that the AFSC region should sponsor. And we were told, oh, you know, people think that the AFSC is too political. That's a political action. And you need to go and talk to every member of the regional executive committee about why this is an appropriate thing for the AFSC to do. And my first reaction was, oh, I've got to go talk to these old conservative Quakers. And we went, and the interaction was so wonderful because we were trying to present it as something that was Quakerly, which it was, and something that was spirit-led, which it was. And as we interacted with these members of the executive committee, we saw how they interpreted what we were saying, and they fed back to us the questions that they had, the concerns that they had, and at the same time, the feeling that it was a right action. And we did. We'd had the silent vigil at the chemical weapons place, sponsored by the region. A lot of Quakers participated. And that was not something that was really common to do in the Midwest at that time. I remember that there was a vigil at the Pentagon that was announced, and people again were saying, oh, this is not the right thing to do. And so there was, the atmosphere was a little different than what it would be now in terms of actions of that kind, because this wasn't, you know, it wasn't anything blatant. It was a silent vigil. And it had some impact when we were in the retreat with Clinton Pettus. He was talking about how we needed to look at what kind of impact we would have. And we were actually able to afterwards talk to some of the people who worked there. And it raised their consciousness too. So it wasn't just a silent vigil. It had some other impacts after that. This became a corporate witness. It was not just my individual angry nonconformity. It was something corporate that we worked out together. And the AFSC is really what led me to Quakerism. And that experience of that job and that those interactions is what really caused me to become a Quaker. So I became very active in the Peace and Social Action Committee. I emphasize the word action, not concern, at Yellow Springs meeting. And this was a very interesting meeting because we had people from a wide spectrum. We had people who worked in military contracts, and we had people who were tax refusers, who had been in prison for conscientious objection in our meeting. And that particular meeting had a practice that they allowed the Peace and Social Action Committee to do things in their own name. And we didn't have to necessarily go to the meeting and get the meeting to sponsor something, but the Peace and Social Action Committee could do it in our name. And that was a very interesting and different kind of thing that I have ever seen in any other meeting that I've been associated with. But we did a lot of actions. And again, we devised the idea in the Peace and Social Action Committee that there should be a peace walk from Yellow Springs to Dayton, which was about 20 miles. And so we thought about how it would be done. Would it be done sponsorship of the Peace and Social Action Committee or what? And it was a recommendation that it be AFSC sponsored. But we decided that we wouldn't try that. And it ended up being sponsored by two individuals, me and one other person in the meeting. And we had a huge turnout on this peace walk. So that was really something. Again, although it wasn't a corporate witness, it was something that grew out of spirit, a spiritual meaning to us. I could go on about a lot of other things of being involved with the SCLC during the Poor People's Campaign. And when I was going through some of my stuff the other day, I found my card that says I was a staff member for SCLC during that time. And my husband was the coordinator for Baltimore City. And the AFSC worked with SCLC quite a bit on their issues. So although I've been on staff of AFSC three more times, and I've been on committees and on the corporation, on the board, I think that my most recent social action with AFSC has been a remove from individual action because I've been on the executive committee, and as Helen said today in her report on AFSC, I'm going to continue on the new South Executive Committee for the Transition. I've been more involved in the decision making and the supporting of staff and this kind of thing than in actually doing the action myself. But in preparation for this, I talked to all of the staff people, except one, in our region, in the Baltimore Yearly meeting area, and about what things they are currently doing that they thought would be useful to tell about in the yearly meeting. And I talked to Dominic Stevenson, who runs the Friend of a Friend program in three prisons in Maryland, and has been invited to do a training or do a program in the women's prison, but only in the diagnostic part of the women's prison. The Friend of a Friend program is very interesting because it is a mentoring program. It came from the men in the prison. Their idea was not Dominique's idea. It was not the committee's idea. It was their idea that they wanted to have a program to mentor people who were coming into the prison and help them to adjust and to have a different way of looking at things. And I was lucky enough to talk to Wahid, who is a former prisoner who is now on probation and is serving as an intern in the Baltimore office to Dominique. And so I asked him, you know, what he thought the program was all about and what it had done for him. And he said, it was the one place where you could be yourself. You didn't have to wear a mask. And he said, everybody in prison wears a mask, and sometimes more than one mask. And in that setting, we could actually talk openly. And we could, it was a small group, but we could talk openly and we didn't have to be afraid. And it became the family within the prison for them. And that, to me, was very powerful. And I thought, talk about a spirit-led witness. That is really a program that is doing something for prisoners that they cannot get otherwise, and that really opens them up. And he said that he felt that his participation in that has now prepared him for being out of prison. And one of the things that I found really astonishing was that they actually have had him visit an elementary school and work with the elementary school children in that school because somebody had met him. And, you know, elementary schools don't usually want to have an ex-prisoner coming in, but he worked primarily with third, fourth, and fifth graders. And during the summer, they have been working on what they call an Eddie Conway Freedom School. And it's named after a prisoner who's in prison for life and who has written a book with Dominique. And he has been changed again by what he experienced in prison, in the program. And they have the Freedom School in partnership with a church in the area where the office used to be. And so they have they had that this summer, and the young woman who's working with the youth empowerment through conflict resolution, who works in the public schools and a charter school in Baltimore on how kids deal with conflict, not only in school, but in their home environments. And they had a special relationship with using tools from Help Increase the Peace, which of course grew out of the AVP program, and other community building skills. And the Eddie Conway Freedom School is working with these kids who are mostly kids who have an incarcerated parent and are therefore at great risk of being victims of violence and ending up in prison themselves, encouraging them to think deeply about their commitment to human rights, which I think is just amazing that those two programs are working on that. Then I talked to Beth Spence. And we have a couple of meetings in West Virginia, so I think I can talk about West Virginia as part of our yearly meeting. And as you know, Rickweth Wilson and Beth Spence have been working there for a long time, and they do mostly advocacy work. And they have actually managed to change public policy in West Virginia. But one of the exciting things they're working on right now is something called the Future Fund, where the idea is to put money aside so that these natural resources that are being extracted from West Virginia, and now it's natural gas, and of course they're doing fracking, that money would be put aside to actually come back to the citizens. And it would be like the Alaska program, where people actually get money back, so that they would get some benefit, whereas now it's been mostly everything taken away from the people who live there. And the other issue that they've been working on, of course, is mining. And the mining, and Helen talked a little bit about this today, about the fact that Beth Spence was one of the people on the state committee that, and she had been actually on it, the earlier one also, for the previous mine disaster, but the Upper Big Branch mine disaster. And they're trying really to work on mine safety legislation. And three members of those Upper Big Branch families went to D.C. To meet with individual members of Congress on mine safety legislation. And Beth worked on that. She said the atmosphere is very toxic in West Virginia on this issue at this point, and on mountaintop removal and all of that kind of thing. But the success they had, or partial success, was the government was going to take away money for child care for poor people. And they mounted a campaign where there was quite a protest against this. And some of it was restored. Okay. Two more people I want to talk about. One is Jean-Louis Ikambana, who works in D.C. with the D.C. Human Rights Learning Program, and they do it in public schools. And he told me about them having a summer project in connection with Davis House, where 10 young people came from First Friends Church in North Carolina, in Greensboro, and to volunteer with the Human Rights Campaign. And what they did was to advocate for marriage equality in Maryland. And they made phone calls. Now, this is something dear to my heart, and I'll tell you why in a second. They had then six D.C. kids who worked on it, worked also this summer, trying to get a bill passed in D.C. To protect D.C. residents from pesticides. And so those are really real spirit-led issues that I think are very important. Ara Kanagas at the Washington office, which is a national program, not a regional program, said that their new project, and Helen mentioned this, no, Helen didn't mention this. Clinton mentioned this yesterday, is to talk to the aides, and they're starting with the Senate, because they think they can have more influence there, about how to develop an atmosphere of trust, because there's such a lack of trust. And so they've been having a listening project with some of these congressional staff people, and how they can share in an inter-party way and the possible ways out. And because dialogue is now considered dangerous, and people have actually been chastised for talking to somebody from the other party. This is either the aides. They were talking about their children, And they were said, you mustn't do that. Now, that's really something. We don't know how that's going to go, but we'll see what happens. Okay. My one other thing I want to mention is that I have been personally involved for some period of time with an action in at a Delphi meeting. And it started out because there were a group of people who were concerned about the reinstitution of giving money to FUM. And we did an epistle, which the first version of really wasn't spirit-led. And we got some feedback. We should have gotten it earlier. We got some feedback, and we said, oh, we have to rethink this. Because it was coming out as being, you're wrong. You should do this differently. And it was redone, and I hope all of you have seen it, because the process, the Quaker process by which it came about was beautiful. And we really listened and thought about, what are we doing? Why are we doing it? What is this about? And so we talked about our experience at Adelphi with being open to people of lesbian and gay, lesbians and gays and couples. And it really turned out to be a very spirit-led epistle. And out of that, the committee, the little ad hoc committee said, you know, we really ought to do a follow-up. And so now we're working on, and I think we have the final letter, that we're sending to people in all the faith communities in Prince George's County, where Adelphi Meeting is, not using the Quaker terminology, but talking about our experience and saying that this is leading us to support marriage equality. And, you know, it's coming up for a referendum, and we're hoping that they will join us. And this is a corporate witness. The epistle, if you go on our website, the epistle is there, signed not just by the clerk, but by almost everybody in the meeting. So it's really a corporate spiritual witness.
Thank you, Jody. When you're ready.
I can't quite reach that. Can you? Thank you. Thanks.
I really appreciated what Jolie said about being an angry young activist, because that definitely speaks to my condition at certain points. When I was in high school and college, I was very involved in social activism, and I was raised to be involved in social activism. My parents were for Wichita, Kansas, my parents were very early adopters in the gay rights movement, and got themselves in trouble with the law for standing on train tracks that were going to bring nuclear bombs across the country, or, you know, walking on a military bases when they weren't supposed to. And so this, you know, it's kind of the family business. But there came a point, and it was. Sometime after September 11th, that I became totally disillusioned with activism and with the political sphere. I think the that point when that realization happened, where I was like, I'm done with this, was actually my first time to come to Washington, D.C., where I now live. I came to Washington for I believe it was a demonstration against military intervention in Afghanistan. But it turns out when I got there, I didn't realize this going in, but when I got there, there were three different demonstrations happening, all of them quite large. And I ended up in the wrong demonstration. I ended up, worthy cause for sure, but I ended up demonstrating for Palestinian liberation rather than against intervention in Afghanistan. And it was such a circus, and people were carrying around signs, in the Palestinian liberation march that I ended up in, folks were carrying signs with, like, Israeli flags turned into Nazi flags and things like that, you know. And it was just such a circus, and I was watching how the powers that be were not responding to this kind of circus, it didn't all come in one blinding flash, and it wasn't entirely something I just thought out. But in retrospect, it was at around that time that I decided that this kind of work is not for me. I need to focus on working out my own salvation with fear and trembling, and not getting so caught up in these kind of goofy struggles. It felt like. And a while after that, I got religion. I became a Quaker. I joined a liberal Quaker meeting in Wichita, Kansas, in 2005, and ended up experiencing a call to ministry. Went to seminary, and very long story, but I ended up out here, living in D.C. and being a part of a Quaker community called Capitol Hill Friends, and also being a part of Ohio Yearly Meeting, which is the conservative yearly meeting. In this area. And I was really just focused on doing ministry and on encouraging the life of the Spirit in my community, and mostly, and still do to a great extent, see sort of the political environment in Washington, D.C. As an obstacle to be overcome rather than an arena in which I work. And so it was with this disdain for what I saw as the three-ring circus of activism that I was sitting on Twitter on September 17th and started seeing tweets come down my feed a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more, talking about this thing that was happening in Lower Manhattan where people were camping on Wall Street and then in this square near Wall Street. And at first, of course, as you might imagine, when I saw this, my reaction was, great, another protest. But the tweets kept coming, and they were still coming on Sunday, and then on Monday. And on Monday, this stuff was still happening, and I decided to take a closer look. And I started reading about what was happening, and immediately I was struck with this sense that this is something real. And something important is happening here. And over the period of a few more days, I ended up, I don't think I would realize I was doing it at the time, but I ended up testing a leading through Facebook. I posted on Facebook, I posted a link to an article I was reading about Occupy Wall Street, which was about 3 days old at that time. And I said, this kind of tempts me to go up to New York City. And within a few hours, I had received a comment from one of my wife's friends saying, well, we live in New Jersey real close by, so if you come up, you can stay with us. And so I just kind of knew in my gut that this is something that I needed to do, and I had a sense that God was directing me to go up to New York. And at that point, I began to realize that it was in those terms that I had a leading to go up there, in spite of myself. And so I did. I went up to New York and participated in the Occupy Wall Street protests for a few days, and was impressed. while I was there, I actually thought that folks there were pretty disorganized. But later, as an organizer of Occupy DC, I realized that they were quite organized. I remember the thing that impressed me most about the demonstrations in New York was the organic commitment to nonviolence that I experienced there, and that wasn't something I was expecting, because when you get a lot of angry radical people into a shared space, usually there's sort of a violent impulse, and I experienced very, very little of that in this group, which was very impressive, because there wasn't actually a top-down institution that said we are nonviolent. It was actually all the individuals coming together into a group and saying we are nonviolent, not because that's an organizational policy, but because that's what we believe, and that's what we believe is effective. And so that was really powerful to see that nonviolent strategy, if not ideology, coming up from the grassroots, and gave me hope, because I knew that violent strategies are self-defeating. So I came back to Washington, D.C., and eventually ended up helping to start Occupy DC. It was kind of weird, and I don't know quite how it happened, but I got linked up with some folks on the internet, and one thing led to another, and before I know it, I'm out on October 1st in McPherson Square helping with Philip Garrison over there too, helping to try to bring some order to this brand new thing we were doing. Philip and I and some others were really trying to bring our experience doing clerking to the facilitation process. Which many of you may know, the sort of business process that has been done in the Occupy movement bears a lot of similarities to our business process. And so we were sort of doing the best we knew how to bring our gifts and our experience to that process. So I was involved in the camp at McPherson Square for about a month and a half before I withdrew. And I was kind of an early withdrawer. There was a point in early November when I sort of felt like, okay, it's probably time to wrap this up now and move on to another tactic, because you know this camping thing is a tactic, and there was a point at which, and I was very early in thinking this, many others disagreed with me at that point, that the tactic had outlived its usefulness and we needed to readapt. Now by January, most everyone agreed that it was time to readapt. So there was a gap. There was a gap there where I sort of didn't know what to do, and was meeting with folks we started an affinity group where we call it the Barcode Affinity Group, because we met at a bar called Barcode, just a little ways from McPherson Square, and we were sort of keeping the flame of reason alive as Occupy and McPherson Square sort of started to unravel, and we were just trying to figure out what's the next step here. And what ended up being the next step for us was helping to start and get involved in a group called Occupy Our Homes DC, which is doing foreclosure resistance and eviction defense. So just as an example, one woman who we're working with right now, her name is Deborah Harris, and she was an EMT paramedic, and one day on the job, she shifted her weight wrong when she was carrying a person, and it just tore her back apart. And so she's disabled. She can't, you know, she can walk, but she can't work. And so she's on disability and, you know, has very low income. And she fell behind on her mortgage payments, and J.P. Morgan Chase just immediately foreclosed on her. And she's actually been sort of struggling with them for the last couple of years, trying to save her house. But they sold her house out from under her. It now belongs to Freddie Mac, and they're working really hard to evict her. And so we're trying to stand with her, so that she doesn't lose her home, and so that, you know, this woman who's a first responder, she's a hero. I mean, have we forgotten 9/11 already? I mean, you know, this is one of the people. If she had been in New York on the day, she would have gone into that building. But we're kicking her and her loved ones to the curb. Just a couple of tangents I want to go on before I close. About working with Deborah Harris. Doing this social this economic justice work has been really stretching for me because like I say, my personal focus for a number of years now has really been on spiritual development and helping myself and helping communities learn how to be faithful and how to hear God's guidance together. And so moving into a more activist and organizing sphere, the emphasis is not as much on listening as it is on winning and on defeating the opposition, which I think has its place. And I'm growing in my appreciation for winning. But it has its dangers too. I think that my instinct back you know, in college, when I just totally stepped back from activism, I think my instinct was right. I think I was right, and I think that activism is something that can be very dangerous to be involved in if you're not firmly rooted in a knowledge of the Spirit of God and a relationship with God. I remember at various times in New York and in D.C. being in marches, and I think many of us have experienced this at different times, being in marches and just feeling like, my feet are coming off the ground. I'm caught up in this euphoria in the crowd, and I'm becoming a part of something. I'm becoming a part of this group, but it's not the Spirit of God. It's something else. And it might be harmless, but it might also be the beginning of a mob. And what is that? And you know, in Scripture we read about there being principalities and powers. There being spiritual forces that we don't entirely understand, but that aren't God. And we need to test the spirits. And so for me, a big challenge has been how do I remain grounded in the Spirit of God, and not get caught up in other spirits that would draw me into action that is not loving. And a specific example of a place where this has been a challenge has been in working with Deborah Harris. We got an opportunity to go and confront Jamie Dimon, who is the CEO and chairman of the board of JP Morgan Chase. So the bank that is working really hard to evict Deborah. He was in D.C. on other business. His company lost something like $7 billion in speculative investments. And he came to, answer for that, or at least in theory, although it seems like he got a pretty favorable treatment from the Senate Banking Committee. But we went to the hearing, too. We went with Deborah because Deborah wanted to talk to Jamie Dimon. And Deborah is a Christian of the more charismatic Pentecostal stripe. She has a very particular way of expressing her faith that sometimes is really cool and sometimes is a little weird. But she went with a clear sense that she was there to deliver ministry, and she was there to speak a word to Jamie Dimon. And I had a sense that my job was to be there with her and pray for her and to help her deliver that ministry. And I felt like I tried to communicate that to the other people in our group that we were going together. But we were sort of not all on the same page. And after Deborah spoke, so Deborah got up and spoke at the very beginning of the Senate hearing, and she had the room. People were listening, and she was really, the room was still. And then she sat back down, and some of the folks in my group began to chant, "Stop foreclosures now." And it made sense. I mean, like, rationally, I understand why we did that, because our goal going in, you know, the winning part, was we wanted to shift the media narrative, because the media was talking about, oh, Jamie Dimon lost these $7 billion. And we're like, what about the thousands of homes and families that are being kicked out on the streets? Isn't that important too? So we had this media objective. We had this political objective. And I think we met it. When you saw the coverage online and then the papers later, the foreclosure issue was brought out. And a part of the reason that happened was because we were chanting "Stop foreclosures now," and it was clear what the message was. But it didn't sit right with me. I felt like when Deborah was speaking out of her experience of being foreclosed on and threatened with eviction and asking Jamie Dimon, when are you going to face the people that you're evicting? The spirit was present in the room, and anyone with ears to hear could hear. But the second we started chanting, it was suddenly just a joke. And it was just, oh, those crazy liberals, or oh, those crazy kids. And I don't think it undid what happened, but I don't think it helped. And I don't think it deepened what happened. So that is the challenge for me, is knowing where that line is, how to be faithful while not completely losing sight of effectiveness and winning. Because I realize now that to some extent, in all the years I'd stepped back from this kind of work, on some level I'd been in a state of despair. And it's good for me. It's right for me to be involved in this work again, because this is real. This isn't theory. This isn't, you know, who's in the White House next term. This isn't, you know, whether we get a little bit of money back on our tax returns or not. But this is whether Deborah can stay in her home. This is whether, you know, she has to go to a homeless shelter, and deal with her back pain and medication issues there. I'm glad that Jolie mentioned West Virginia, because that's real too. Mm-hmm. And I hope that we're aware that the political climate in this country, and political, that's not the word I mean, but just try to hear what I mean with that word, political. The climate in this country is shifting, and it's getting nasty. And I don't understand what's happening, but people are being beaten and tortured in West Virginia. Sure. Right now, there are people who have been imprisoned and put under $25,000 bond, each person, for doing a pretty basic demonstration. Like, is not a very intense deal. Like, basically going and they were trying to like close down the entrance to a strip mining operation for a few hours. And so, you know, they weren't cooperative with the police, and they've been put in jail under $25,000 bonds that has to be paid with West Virginia sureties, meaning it has to be property in West Virginia. And there are descriptions of what's been going on in that jail, of one of the activists being beaten so badly that others who saw the cell said the cell was covered in blood. Mm-hmm. So this is real. This isn't a game. And God cares. And God has a call for each of us to play. And I believe that God has a call for Baltimore Yearly Meeting. And I pray that you will be blessed in listening this week.
Friends, we have some time for questions for these two after these powerful testimonials. At least that's what I'll call them. I'm happy to recognize any of you who have questions for Micah, for Jolie, or for both of them. Clarification, similar stories, what did they mean? What did something mean? I see a hand from Mona.
Chose to step off the sidewalk into the gutter, that you said you didn't feel that was spirit-led, and then also you said you felt angry. So I'd really be interested in your commenting on that. When you are alone or when you are thinking of an action, either of you, and deciding whether to take it, what are some clues when you feel it is spirit-led and when it's not?
Well, I think at this point, I really think that something is more likely to be spirit-led if it's a corporate witness, if you can meet with other people and really seek clearness and determine whether this is something that you just want to do or is it something that you're led to do. I think that being spirit-led can start from an individual's feeling of leading, but that when it really comes through, it's because you have met together and you have seasoned it and you have worked with the implications of it and understand that this is something that really needs to happen, and that you would put it as God is calling you to do it, and I guess I could say it that way too.
Another clue that I definitely agree that the corporate discernment piece is really important, and whenever we can do that, we should put up with the nuisance that it causes, because sometimes corporate discernment is really annoying.
Yeah. And difficult.
Yes. But even in individual discernment, which is also, it's also helpful in corporate discernment, but even in individual discernment, I feel like there are some telltale signs of a leading as opposed to something else. And probably the most basic one is, and this takes a while to figure out, obviously. That's why discernment isn't easy. But is it grounded in love, and not just a feeling, and not just a warm fuzzy, but is it grounded in self-giving, and a willingness to lay down one's own life for the life of others? Is it grounded in that? I think is a really important starting place.
Okay, please in the back, Carol.
They do is the coke problem, and what did it do to them, and what did they see it doing to you, and then when did they, oh, there you go again, and I've learned better to play my role and wait for him to come back and wash the clothes or whatever it does, you know, because if you're married, if you have a partnership, it's a two-body problem, and you need to be able to talk about, can we see what we're doing to each other, as well as in larger levels, right. Of what are we doing to everyone. And what are the fruits?
Well, I was very fortunate that my husband and I often had the same leadings. And we did things together a great deal of the time in terms of social action. So that was not difficult at all. the one problem that we had was sometimes we wanted to do something and we had these three children that sort of limited our activities. And then we would have to choose which one of us would be able to really do the action that needed to be taken as we saw it.
Yeah, my discernment process would be a lot weaker if I did not have my wife Faith as a part of it. And in our relationship, Faith doesn't usually think that she has a strong opinion about things in general, but especially about my sense of leading or not leading. But the way it tends to play out is I tend to ask her direct questions about the leadings I'm feeling and the senses that I have. And many times, it's not a guarantee that it's right, but many times when it is right, she'll just say, yeah, sure. But what I watch for, she'll rarely come out of me and say, no, that's a horrible idea, Micah. Not because she wouldn't, but because that's just not how she works. She doesn't come to split-second decisions like that. But a great thing about living with someone over a long period of time is you start to pick up on their mannerisms, and you can tell sometimes what they think before they know what they think. Mm-hmm. And so I know I need to go back and look at it again and maybe revise the draft, so to speak, when she sort of pauses for a second and there's just sort of a little freeze. And I'm like, oh, there's something there. there's something off there, and I need to look at that.
And one of the nice things about that kind of a relationship is that it can be part of your discernment process, you know, that you test your ideas against each other and come up with something better.
God works in mysterious ways. More questions on this side, please, right here in the red top, please.
When you were talking about how sometimes a group can go from being sort of pacifist to a mob, probably, I don't know, 8 or 10 years ago, I was one of the adults taking the junior young friends to what was supposed to be a vigil around the White House. They were aiming to encircle the White House with people. And there were protests also going on that we had no intention of being part of. And when we arrived, there were some women in black before I knew what women in black were, and there were, you know, a couple other folks, and there were some women in pink. And when we arrived with the kids, we probably doubled the size of the group that was there. And when it was a vigil, the police were fine. They did not mind us being right in front of the White House. And then one of the women in pink was like, okay, we've got critical mass, let's start trying to encircle the White House. And we became that mob. We were no longer standing in our truth, we were following her directions. And in that split second, the police were no longer comfortable with us there, and they told us we had to leave or we were going to jail. They didn't care for if we were looking around to make sure we had all our little people. And it was such a powerful experience for me to just physically feel the difference between a vigil and a protest, and the physical difference of standing in my truth and standing in opposition to someone else's. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, that sort of microsecond shift that can happen that you were talking about. Mm-hmm. And it is, I mean, I've never been to a protest since, because that's not where the power is. The power is, and in your discussion of Ms. Harris, the power was when she was talking in her own truth. I think that you just, like, hit the nail on the head with that one. Thank you.
Just comment really briefly on that. Interesting thing, you were talking about Code Pink? We got arrested for the action with Deborah Harris, and we got it's been rougher than it should have been. We'll leave it at that. I'm not convinced we would have even been arrested, and I don't think things would be quite as hard on us. Except there was a member of Code Pink who was there, and got up right before us and started ranting and screaming and kind of set the whole mood. So this is not only your experience.
Joel, anything you want to add? You want to add anything to that?
Any other questions? Sure, please, Noel. Yeah, Mark, come on, you.
I want to kind of build on what the friend asked. Now, first of all, I want to thank you for your candor in sharing both your experiences in the journey that you took in your own spiritual action, from where you were and where you are now with it, and what was motivating you. And I'm curious, from your experience, where you see the opportunity and the challenges for Quaker testimony within social action, within working with people who are not Quakers, whether they're black box anarchists, whether they're members of other religious groups. Where do you, can you speak to where you see the opportunity for what we hold and what we believe to work within that structure with other people involved in social action?
In 25 words or less. No. You want to breathe first a little bit?
That's really tough. Yeah. And the only thing that I can think of to say in response to that is that I believe that if we are open and listening to the other people who are involved and stick to our own testimony, that is the only opportunity that I see. But maybe there are others.
My experience so far, and you know, I've been an organizer for like 9 months now. So, but my experience so far has been really that what the wider activist and organizer world has really offered me is tools and strategy and tactics and ways of winning, which are really important because sometimes we need to win. Sometimes it's important to win. But what these communities do not offer me, and what I hope that I can in some measure open up an avenue for in these communities, is meaning, and a truth that goes beyond simply what we would like. And my experience so far in these communities has been that it is full of people who are desperately looking for meaning, and who are using political activism as their outlet, where I think, you know, most of us are the place where we go for meaning is meeting. The place where we go for meaning is waiting in the stillness on God's movement in our hearts, and gathering together in that truth. And I want to offer that possibility to folks for whom the deepest meaning they have is let's stop fracking, or let's defeat Mitt Romney. And as important as those causes can be, it doesn't provide the kind of deep meaning that I think is sustaining over the long term, and which ultimately can guide us in ways that make us more loving and more self-giving. And so just on a really, that was a little bit theoretical, but just on a very practical level, for me it's really important to talk, like whenever it's appropriate, like I don't force it, but whenever it's appropriate, I talk explicitly about my faith. And you know, if it comes up in conversation, someone, you know, is talking about, you know, I'm doing this because of X, Y, and Z, and they might even ask me, so, you know, how'd you get involved in this? And that question's asked a lot, actually. My question is, well, you know, I felt like God was calling me to do this, and when I read in Scripture about Jesus's ministry, at the heart of his entire ministry, at the heart of why he died and why he rose again, was liberation for the weakest and the most despised and the most marginalized, and so I, as a Christian, feel really called to stand with the poor and with the oppressed and with those who are marginalized. And when it comes in that context of we're sharing about our own journeys, it's a mutual sharing, I think that can be powerful.
I don't know how you follow up on that, but there are hands here. Marjorie, in the green shirt, please. Okay, and you'll be next.
I agree with the thought that it is wise when you want to start a project to get some people together and talk it over with somebody. That has helped me at times when I've been told that you're off the wall. This is not the time to do something. But on the other hand, I've been supportive when ideas have come and people have supported me, etc. I was thinking way back many years ago, after Martin Luther King's death, Ted Robinson, I think probably Jolie should tell this story. Ted Robinson did something that was very helpful to the whole city. You tell it, Jolie.
I don't know what you're talking about. Which thing? Which thing that he did?
This was a time when he did not call a group together to do what he wanted to do. He wanted to get the city to be calm. There were groups in the town that were standing ready, wanted to start throwing things at windows and cause havoc. Ted, as I understand it, got in a car and took a microphone and went around the city saying, let us be calm, let us think this thing through and see what we could do to really, really commemorate Martin Luther King's death. Not by destroying anything.
Any comment, Julie?
No, I remember that. There were so many things that that you could have been referring to. One of the things that happened during the so-called riots in Baltimore after Martin Luther King was assassinated was that the AFSC office was inside the area where nobody was supposed to come out of. Nobody was supposed to be in there. So the National Guard had it all cordoned off. And Ted went in and stayed at the office and fielded calls, talking to the governor, talking to various people in the administration, who were saying pretty nasty things about black leadership and why aren't you doing these things and why aren't you calming down those riotous people and so on. And he spent several nights there in the office trying to work with people, not always successfully.
Then we had a question over here, I believe. There were a bunch of hands. Yes, please. You got the phone. Good. Just keep talking. He'll put it on.
I was listening to you use the word self-giving a few times and thinking that when you engage in spirit-led action, at the beginning you probably anticipate that you yourself are going to be changed in the process. And you won't be the same person at the end of the action as you were when you began.
That's true.
And that must be very scary as you're entering into the action. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to hear, if that is true, if you could talk about that experience, both of you.
It's very helpful to be naive. I've already mentioned this action, but I'm going to mention it again because it is the most recent and most intense action I've been involved in. When we went to speak to Jamie Dimon, the person who had the bright idea informed us that, oh yeah, no, it's no big deal. There's no way we're going to get arrested. we're just gonna say something to Jamie Dimon and then we're gonna leave, and that's allowed before the Senate hearing starts, which technically is true. But that's not how it played out, and we ended up being put in handcuffs and put in a wagon and taken over to the jail and chained. It's kind of weird. It's almost like you imagine dungeons, right? Like literally chained to a wall for hours at a time, and by the end of it, especially when the FBI computer came back saying that I was not in fact Micah Bales, I was Kenneth Perez and wanted on drug charges.
What?
at that point, the outside world was receding, and all that seemed real was what was inside that jail, and wondering how long I was going to be there, and being moved from room to room and from cell to cell, and feeling more like an object than like a human being, and really scraping and looking for ways to maintain my dignity. That was a transformative experience. That was a tiny taste of jail for me, and that was a tiny taste of what it's like to be in real literal bondage for me, who is not in real literal bondage too often. And I learned that jail is very conducive to prayer. Jail is very conducive to singing songs. And jail is a place where your best hope is the people you were arrested with, because those are the people who can help you maintain perspective. And I would say the transformative piece there is since that experience, it's not the same when I read about people being arrested and kept in prison over periods of time. I have an idea of what that's like now, and I know it is not simply not being allowed to leave a building. It is a lot more than that. Yeah. And it's a system of oppression.
Julie, you want to add anything?
I sure can't match that story, because I have fortunately or unfortunately never been arrested for anything. But you were asking how the experience transforms you, the person who's doing it. And I believe that what happens is that you get a whole different perspective on the other people that you're with, on yourself, and a different perspective on what the issue is that you're working with. And I've had a similar experience, of doing something that sort of changed and became something I didn't want it to be. And then what do you do? Do you just leave? Do you try to deal with people and say, this is not what we came for? And that can be a really difficult place to be. But it's made the actions that I've participated in that have been, I think, spirit-led, have made me stronger and made me feel that I'm able to articulate issues better. And I don't know whether that's what you're talking about or not, but that's been my personal experience.
Who has the most profound closing question here? All right, front row.
You're on.
No pressure, huh?
Well,
excuse me. Okay. I have a response to our friend's question from a while back, but the question that I thought was very relevant was, how do Quakers participate in larger questions with other folks who may have different approaches? I worked with Greenpeace for 14 years, and we had an answer to that Greenpeace is often criticized for not working in coalitions. And I think there's a very good reason sometimes for not working in coalitions, and that's because if you have a certain approach that you think has power, that has integrity, it's very hard to maintain that if you're working in coalitions. Mm-hmm. I got into Greenpeace because it felt spirit-led at the time, and throughout many actions, I felt like it maintained that. I ultimately left in the early 90s because it got to a point for me where it felt like, although there was an ethic of nonviolent direct action, it often was only carried out in a strategic sense, often not in a spiritual sense. And so I left and have pursued my own thing with varying paths. But becoming a Quaker the year after I left Greenpeace has provided a lot of opportunity to explore that path in different ways. And certainly trying to find ways to do that that maintains Quaker integrity, I think, is very important. Greenpeace was a catalyst for many other movements in the same way that I think Quakers acting may not be part of the largest thing on the block, but acting with spiritual integrity, we can still be very important catalysts for other people and set the example for others.
Comments on that?
I sure agree with that. And AFSC has come to some of the same conclusions of not working in coalitions unless we're absolutely sure that the coalition that we're forming has the same approach and the same spiritual basis that we have. So,
will both of you be here the rest of the week?
No.
You're leaving.
I'm unfortunately leaving tomorrow, and it's not totally unfortunate because I'm going to a family reunion out in Denver and then on a vacation.
So if you want to see more of Julie, grab her tonight or breakfast, I suppose. You'll be here a little longer?
In my case, I'll be here until Friday evening, and I have a workshop on Friday afternoon, Occupy Our Faith, and I don't know what the rules are here, but if you can
advertise, shamelessly advertise.
Well, if those are the rules, then come to mine.
I don't know whether it's appropriate to clap or to cheer, but I have really enjoyed working with you two tonight, and I think the rest, I see the looks on the faces, so at least we'll give you a Quaker wave. But I would assume you're here to answer any more questions if people want to come and talk to you.
Absolutely.
One-on-one. But thank you all for coming. And tomorrow morning, breakfast, and then worship sharing starts up. Are there any announcements? There's probably somebody with some announcements that wants to address the body.
Going to the intervisitation.
There's intervisitation tonight
at 9:15, and
that's
all
right.
Of you are welcome to come. And I already invited Micah.
Okay, so keep alert. Daily bulletin will be out first thing in the morning, and there's worship sharing tomorrow, and business meeting, and all kinds of good stuff. Workshops in the afternoon. Yearly meetings really getting underway now. So welcome aboard.
That was amazing.
Thanks.
A wonderful colleague to have here. Inspired by the future Quakers and all of a sudden.
Maybe even the present.
Between you and the present? I don't know. You said you weren't that political. So.